Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Who Inspire. My guest today is Megan Buchanan, and for a hobby, Megan does mountain climbing. So, Megan, that's really exciting. How long have you been doing that?
Well, that is a great question. I would like to say I actually probably started doing that as a toddler in the back of my dad's backpack. My dad was really into the outdoors and mountaineering, not super technical level, but hiking. And so I'd be in that backpack in the back of him always. And then as I got older and he could take me along with him, I'd say I probably really started hiking around 8 years old. And I've got two siblings, well, but this was the thing that was my dad's and my special thing that we do together. So sort of my whole life, it was building up to this.
So what mountains have you climbed?
Well, you know, just starting out younger, living in Colorado, we've got 54 mountains over 14,000 feet. So I've climbed quite a bit through there. But then I started traveling around the world and taking on little things like Machu Picchu. And then the first time I climbed Kilimanjaro was actually with my father and my family. And so that was one of my first of the seven summits, the highest peak in Africa. I climbed Kilimanjaro with him. And it kind of started off from there. Then I went and did Everest Base Camp. And when I finally got the bug of I want to do all seven summits, I have now completed four of those. So actually Kilimanjaro twice. I've climbed Elbrus, which is the highest peak in Europe, in Russia. I climbed Aconcagua, the highest peak in South America, which is in Argentina. And then last July, I actually just did Denali in Alaska, which, of course, is the highest in North America.
Wow.
This year, yeah, I was scheduled to climb Mount Everest. So much training went involved, but because of COVID-19, Everest actually was shut down. So I am rescheduled to climb that next spring.
So I don't mountain climb, but I climb stairs. So I know that the equivalent of Mount Everest is 57,000 stairs. So that's my goal for the year, to climb 57,000. And this way I could, I climbed Mount Everest this year. So...
I love that. I love that.
So when you train for a summit like that, how long do you train for?
You know, that is also a great question. I get asked that a lot. It's always kind of hard to answer. I'm actually living in California, Southern California right now for work. When I lived in Colorado in Vail, every day was training. You're just surrounded by the outdoors. I was always hiking and mountain biking. So California, I actually really had a lot more purpose with how I was working out and training. So for something like Everest, you're always training. And a lot of people train usually a year is the typical for it. But since I have kind of been back to back in these and been on this roll for so long, I'm always in a training mode. Usually when I get done with a huge climb, your body does need to recover. I give myself a break for about a month, maybe eat a little extra, not work out quite as hard and let my body recover, but then I usually go right back into training. And what I'm doing right now is, especially being a weekend warrior, I do have a day job. So I mountain bike a lot, which is really amazing for your legs and your lungs. Just generally during the week, I will run. I do actually a lot of Pilates and yoga, which I've found is amazing for core strength, which you need. Closer to an expedition, I really get into the gym and do a lot more with weights, with legs and upper body. And then also any and every time you can actually go outside and hike, that is the best training. And a lot of times I'll weight down my pack especially training for something like Denali, where you are required to carry such a heavy pack and pull a sled, I definitely needed to have a lot more strength than normal expeditions. So you're kind of always training.
So when you're required to carry your backpack with you, how heavy is it?
And again, that's expedition to expedition. It just depends. I'd say Denali is the heaviest it's ever been. And because that a lot of these mountains that you climb, they're supported, which means you will have porters or Sherpas carrying your tent, a lot of the group equipment, all sorts of different items. So you're really just sort of responsible for some or all of your personal items, which makes the pack lighter. Denali is different because you as a team carry everything. It is unsupported. So that's why you have sleds behind you as well. You're carrying all the team gear, food. So that was very heavy. And generally your packs are around 50 pounds and you're pulling around 50 pounds, which is a lot heavier. The thing that I love to tell people, and this is especially when I talk to women's groups, the mountain is an equalizer, and it's amazing. And they don't care, you know, the groups, all these mountaineering companies are so great and really want to encourage women to get into mountaineering. That means carrying your fair share. So with group gear, they don't care if you're male, you're female, you're 200 pounds, you're 100 pounds, you're carrying the same amount of group weight. So, you know, you definitely put in your time on a Denali trek. But the other ones, like Aconcagua actually was half unsupported, so I had a pretty heavy pack on that one. It also depends on the duration. If it's a two-week trek, if it's a month, that will determine, of course, how much extra clothing, food, gear that you have. So, sorry, this is a long answer, but I'd say anywhere from, generally like a 30-pound day pack type of thing up to 50-pound Denali pack with and or sled is usually where you're around.
So you carry it on your back all day long. That's going to take a lot of endurance. How do you prepare for something like that?
That also is a great question because we can talk about the physical training, but really to be able to do a Denali and Everest, it is a lot of mental and emotional training. And that is why a lot of people, you can be, 20-something years old and so strong and have that kind of physical endurance. But it's not something I recommend you just go do because what your body goes through takes the time and the education and the experiences to understand and be able to process and then mentally push through. So I do think that the training for that portion of it is experience, is pushing yourself, is going and, starting sort of that crawl, walk, run, get yourself used to how your body feels, understand how your gear works, understand how you deal in extreme cold, without showers for 3 weeks, all these different situations. You need to practice that to have the mental and emotional strength to be able to carry on in a long-term duration expedition, to have that mental fortitude to, okay, I've been here for 35 days and today I'm going to keep going forward. So it's a lot of mental and emotional strength.
That's totally amazing. So are there more and more women mountain climbers?
There are lots of female mountain climbers for sure, but there aren't as many as there should be. And I think that we're just in such an amazing time in our history right now where not only are women doing these things, but we're shifting. We see a shift in where we should be messaging more and encouraging more of it, that this isn't a male thing to do. My day job, so I'm an aerospace engineer. So I see a lot of the parallels in women in engineering as well. I think that's one thing that I love, making those contrasts between the two, because they're very similar. In STEM careers, you know, we still have probably 20-25% of upper management jobs, that sort of thing, that are female. And I think in mountaineering, it's around the same amount of numbers. And so I think when I was little, it was kind of messaged like, oh, wow, well, you know, okay, you're a girl, I guess you could do that. And now I think we're really messaging to young girls, why wouldn't you do that? Of course, go ahead and do it. So I've also noticed a trend with a lot of the mountaineering companies here in the United States. RMI is really great. I've used Climbing the Seven Summits is another really great one. There's so many wonderful ones that really have put together programs bringing in female guides and support to try to build female participation in mountaineering. So where there aren't as many as there should be, but I really love where a lot of these companies are going, trying to help influence. And another reason I get out and speak about it is to help encourage women to get into this as well.
So do you also speak about women getting into aerospace and engineering?
Of course.
Oh, boy.
Of course. I say, you know, I think I started probably giving back in college. I was starting talking to high school girls about, you know, going into math and science. That's been a passion of mine. I'm definitely talking to youth for a really long time. And then over the last couple of years, as I set the goal to climb the seven summits and do the North and South Pole as well, then I really started focusing on women, really talking to women about going after the things they wanted to do and having the courage to try and fail and try again. And so in engineering, definitely, I had amazing, amazing parents who believed in me. I'm also dyslexic, so it was a challenge, but I wanted so badly to be an aerospace engineer and worked really hard to get there. So it is important to me to give back and encourage girls and women to do what they're passionate about. And whether that's engineering or something else, to make their own rules going forward, and not fall into stereotypes, not fall into what society expects, but to truly go after what they're interested in. And if it's math and science, keep at it.
You know, you talked about a really important word, and that's courage. I'm a baby boomer, and I grew up during the women's movement. So I kind of lived through the evolution and so forth. And courage has never been a concept that's been encouraged. Because, you know, there's a lot of women who want to do this, that, or the other thing. And there's not really the support system for them. Therefore, they never gain that courage. Would you agree?
I totally agree with that. You know, it's been really amazing for me as I am trying to form this platform called Grit. I'm speaking a lot more to groups. I started writing a book, and what that does is it does make me reflect on everything in my life. And even though, you know, I attribute so much to two amazing parents that supported me and encouraged me, I went through life, of course, at times filled with doubt from you get messaging all around you in your bubble from people who, you know, you work with, from schooling. And you have to be able to, I guess, overcome all the messaging around you. And so you've got to work on that core inside. And again, luckily I had two parents who kept backing me up until I learned that voice for myself. But so many women that I talked to did not have that. And so exactly what you're saying, when you don't have that strong foundation, it's really hard to keep going after the things you want when you're being told you shouldn't be there. And so, again, I think what you're doing is amazing, trying to give voice to this to women, because they can, every woman and every person can build this within themselves. But you need a support group. And so, you know, avenues like this podcast, you know, different women out there trying to support each other is an amazing way to start finding that encouragement.
Thank you. What do you think has been more challenging, math and science or mountain climbing?
That is the best question I think I've ever gotten. Wow, that is such a good question. And you know what? I guess there isn't one that's harder than anything else. I guess for me personally, probably the math and science was, just, and I'll explain why. Passionate about both. But I will say, being dyslexic and being a female made pursuing an aerospace degree very difficult and very challenging. And I guess mainly because of the naysayers and everyone who said that, you know, I couldn't do it or I shouldn't be here. Mountaineering is very physically and mentally challenging. But there is a difference between the two. I can show up day one at school or for a job, and I can show up day one on the mountain. Whoever there might have the same, might try to sum me up. I am tall, I am blonde, I'm very bubbly. So probably either one, I get the response of, yeah, right, like she could do this. The mountain, though, there is nothing you can do to take away achievements on a mountain. There isn't someone doing the work for you. So every day, people around you in a team build together. They know who's doing the teamwork. They know who's putting in. No one's going to get them to the top of the mountain without them doing some work. In any sort of field, a career, you can always have people that are trying to throw your achievements on, well, she didn't work hard enough for this, or whatever it is. So in a way, I love the mountain more, because really you get the results, the hard work you put in, you get the results, and you get the respect, and that's just really rewarding.
Now, I believe, I'm not sure, but people who are dyslexic have problems with the sequence of the alphabet and reading, right? Is that right?
Correct. That is one of the, one of the what happens. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, getting an advanced degree in engineering, you know, took a lot of reading. So as a college student, how did you cope with that?
It kicked my butt. And
really?
it was very difficult. And it's so funny now, I as a younger out of college in a career, I wouldn't tell people at work I was dyslexic. I didn't want to be labeled. I, you know, felt that I was always trying to make up for it. I felt less than for being dyslexic. It was later in my career that I really figured out the advantages of who it has made me. But what I go back now and teach kids is to be proud and own exactly who they are. And I share with them, I probably had to repeat like calculus 2. I think I had to take it 3 times. I failed classes. I could not keep up with the reading. First went to college, I also was in a way too embarrassed or proud. I did not get signed up with the Learning Disabilities Center, and so I did not qualify for untimed tests. It wasn't until my junior year I finally sort of settled into who I am, and I asked for the help and started getting it and realizing how to navigate through my learning disability and be more proud of who I am than embarrassed. So it was tough. And still to this day, I cannot spell. It is so bad. Luckily, we have so much like spell check. Luckily, I have an amazing sister. The dyslexia did not affect. I can call her anytime and be like, how do you spell this one word? Here I am like a professional, but I'm also just very open about it with other people and let them know ahead of time. I do apologize if this is not spelled correctly, but you know, spell checker can only do so much for me. But yeah, it is part of the rear kicking that I went through in my life, I think, to build up, you know, part of who I am and grit, the ability to keep adapting and the resilience to keep marching forward even when you fail.
So when you read a book, you know, I like to sit down and I like to read. So, you know, I could go through a book in a couple of days if it's, you know, fairly lengthy. When you open up to read a book, is it a different experience for you than it is for me?
Probably. Probably is. And that's the thing, I don't know any different. You know, I don't know any different. I do know that it literally, you learn a lot of coping mechanisms. You learn a lot of tricks to make things easier for yourself. And some people have the notion that like dyslexia goes away. It doesn't go away. You just learn to deal with it. And when I was a child, I can remember reading, and I would read a chapter and I would not retain a single word in that chapter. And it was very frustrating for me. And the words, when you read across, it's almost like letters and words from different rows will jump and switch and turn around. So it's very difficult. My sister and I used to have a game where she'd have me look at a billboard of driving really quick. She's like, what did it say? And I'll just spit out the first thing. And it's always hilarious because it's never what was written. But, you know, early on, my parents realized things. If I listened to something, I retained it very well. And, of course, they knew that I was very intelligent. I just was having trouble reading. So my dad got a little tape recorder, and I'd take a book, and I'd start reading it. Then I'd play back the recording for myself as I reread it again. And listening to it, I'd retain it. So we started, like, coming up with these new little things to help me identify or help me retain the information. And we'd also take, like, little cue cards and cut out one line of text, and it was all white around. So if I could just focus on the one line and read across and then move my card down to the next line, that helped my brain focus on what was in front of me. So it was just a lot of adapting and being creative to get through it. And as I got older, I learned to enjoy reading. And because I'm constantly thirsting for knowledge and learn different things. And I am to a point with my dyslexia that it no longer makes me cringe, but I enjoy reading. It may not be as fast as everyone else, but it no longer angers me or scares me.
Well, you know, what you're talking about is really interesting. What percentage of the population would you say is dyslexic?
I have not looked that up in a really long time. And there used to be stats, too, that there's more dyslexia in the United States with the English language than any other language. But also that could be because, you know, perhaps we're a country that has looked into it more and, you know, gotten more statistics on it. But it is interesting because all friends that I have, and they do little things, and I'm like, I think you got a little touch of dyslexia in there. So that's a great question. I don't know how many are, but I think that there are quite a few people that are that do have it and have never been diagnosed as having it.
Wow. So I was introduced to you by Stephanie Hutchins, who was also a mountain climber. Where did you meet her?
So I met Stephanie actually in Russia, climbing Elbrus. Yes, I know. That's one of the amazing things about these trips. I do a lot of research into what company I'm going to go with. And you end up climbing a mountain usually with people that you've never met before, and you are complete strangers day one. And by the time you complete your journey and fly out, you have new best friends. And I stay in touch. I mean, it's such a bonding experience to go through what you go through, and you as a team work on survival together. So, it really bonds you in a way that's very hard to describe, but you stay in contact with each other forever.
That's great. And I'm sure, you know, Stephanie isn't the only person that you've developed a good friendship with, right?
Yeah, she is absolutely fascinating. You know, I have to say, Elbrus is one of the shorter trips. It doesn't take many days to do it. But the small amount of time that I was with her, she absolutely, something about her inner energy, and she just, like, I don't know how to say it, but she just glows from the inside. Like, she is just doing her best to truly live her best life. And honor who she is. And it is, it's really an amazing thing. And it is crazy too, she shared her journey with why she got into, hiking and mountain climbing. And I think she kind of came from a background that it wasn't really something that she grew up with, but it was something because I think that she connected with what I love about it as well, is that during that time, you are stripped down to really just who you are, how you treat other people, teamwork, all of these, you know, crazy little problems melt away. There aren't any. And it's such an amazing way to be authentic. And I think she got hooked on that, which is why I think a lot of us do. So we really shared that in common. And, we kind of keep up, I think, on Facebook. It's really great to see where everyone is. Once in a while, you WhatsApp with each other or share gear information, just find out where each other's going.
So we just have about a minute left, Megan.
Yeah.
Give yourself a little plug.
So I have a website just done by me. I'm working during this quarantine time or whatever. I'm trying to work on getting a little bit better, but www.grit, and it's GGRIT, and it stands for gratitude, growth, resilience, integrity, and tenacity. So grit.com. And you can find out about me there and also check out my expeditions. Hopefully do the Adventurers Grand Slam and learn about speaking engagements. And really also, if you have got, you know, just a kid or someone in your life that could use some encouraging words, I love speaking to schools, helping encouraging any kids I can and women. So I would love for you to get in contact with me.
Thanks, Megan. So you've been listening to Megan Buchanan, and I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is Women Who Inspire. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Women Inspire 21. Megan, you are a joy to talk to, and I hope everybody will have a good Mother's Day weekend.
Thank you so much, and you too. Thank you. Bye.